Hello.
Hello. Okay. You are listening to The Witching Hour. Oh, wait. No, I did it in the wrong order. You are listening to IHDX.FM in Conway, Arkansas. But more importantly, you are listening to The Witching Hour. How are you doing, JC?
All right. I was sick last week, so yeah. I've been stressed this week.
So, obviously, on the day... Oh, yeah. Did you get over that?
Yeah, then I started my menstrual cycle, so then I wasn't good either. But like,
I'm sorry.
I was like, just a second, if I could like breathe, that'd be cool, but we're good.
Yeah. At the time that we're recording this, it is November 6th at 2:17 Arkansas time, which I think is, what are we, Eastern time?
Central.
Wait, what are we? No, Central.
And we don't know who our president is.
Well, I was going to say, I guess we should address the elephant in the room. Tad the cat has not been to the Hendricks campus.
Different
you
priorities.
Or anyone you know knows what happened to Tad the cat.
My friend from UCA just sent me a picture
Please
of the...
Let us know.
Yeah. That's the real mystery.
Find our boy. Bring him back. And for those of you who don't know, our college has a feral cat colony who, like, they are feral, but they're all spayed and neutered, and they're all fed regularly, and they all have names and a family tree, and they're taken care of, and they're registered under, like, the Hendricks College as, like, their pet.
Animals.
And someone left a note outside of a building from the perspective of Tad the cat, saying basically that he had been stolen.
He's a father.
And he was going to go live a new life like he'd always wanted. It was very odd. Yeah, it was very alarming, and we want him back because pet theft is illegal, and everyone is very worried about his well-being.
The true crime of the century.
So bring him home. Spread the word. So that's all that I had to say leading up to this episode. JC, if you want to say anything else or just start your segment, go ahead.
Well, I haven't done much of anything, so I think Tad the Cat was a good intro.
Thank you. Just trying to spread the word to all six of our listeners.
My UCA friend just sent me a picture of it and was like, "What's happening?" I'm like, "It's a crime."
It is, and, like, I'm surprised that it hasn't been its own email.
It's been in the communications.
Yeah, it's been in communications, but does anyone actually read those?
I do.
I mean, me too, but, like, I don't know. I didn't read them at all freshman year.
I don't know.
Okay,
it makes me nervous not to read things.
Yeah. At this point, like, we know that whoever saw him has to have seen something about it at this point. Or whoever stole him has to have seen something about it. Like, they can't not know that he's being looked for.
Who knows?
Well, we'll see. What I'm kind of hoping is that whoever has him is trying to keep him indoors. Because, what are you doing?
Sorry, I'm, like, tapping my computer. I realized it was louder than I thought.
Oh, yeah, it was very loud. that whoever took him is trying to keep him indoors, because you can't just, like, take a cat that has lived its whole life outside and is accustomed to outside and try to bring it in, like, indoors. They don't adjust. They're not like dogs. You can't just...
Yeah, I don't know a lot about cats.
And expect them to stay there. So I'm kind of worried that... I do, unfortunately. I mean, fortunately. I'm kind of thinking that he might be, like, destroying their furniture and trying to escape. And if he does escape, I'm worried that he's just never going to be seen again.
That is a concern. I don't know how to...
So whoever has him just needs to bring him back before... Yeah.
being a
Tad. Because I think something inevitably bad could happen.
Tad is my only source of serotonin.
Okay, JC, do you want to start?
By DW, so. Yeah. So, at the end of this, if you'd like, you get to see a picture, but it's up to you.
Okay.
Like, I was going to send it to you, make you look at it, but then I realized I should probably, like, ask if you'd like to in hindsight. So we're going to wait till the end for that part. But I'm I have to pull it up because I am a little bit of a fool. So, this is set in Alaska, which is one of the 6 states who have not reported their voting totals. So, this is in 2012, February 1st. A guy goes to pick up his 18-year-old girlfriend, Samantha, from the coffee stand where she works at. And it's kind of like one of those kiosks, you know, like, Think Coffee. So he gets there, and she's not there. And he's like, that's weird. Maybe I got the time wrong. But then he gets a text from her, and it says, hey, I'm staying with friends for a couple of days. Tell my dad. And he's like, that's not right. So he talks to the owner, and they're like, we have CCTV. And we're like, great, can we, like, look at that? And he's like, yeah. So I dropped my mic. In the footage, you can see the customer approach the stand, and she hands him a cup. And this is also on YouTube. I didn't watch it, but he points at something behind her, and she turns around to look. And when she turns back, she jumps back like she's kind of scared and throws up her hands. She then turns off the lights and lays on the ground, and a man in a ski mask crawls through the window, takes Samantha, and pulls her through the window and disappears down the street. So they, like, kind of look through social media and everything, and they can't find any suspects or anything. So 2.5 weeks later, on February 24th, 2012, her boyfriend gets another text from her phone, and it says, Connor Park, which is a local dog park, sign under pic of Albert. Ain't she pretty?
Ugh.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like ain't she pretty. So they go to the dog park, and they found a Ziploc bag with a ransom note for $30,000 and a picture of Samantha with a paper from that day. Oh, my computer's falling. Sorry. Well, because I had a bit of a headache, so I was like, I'm gonna lay in bed and have the lights off. So, like, I'm situated and, like, leaned back where my head doesn't hurt. But it's not a flat surface, so my computer's turning. And I'm not very agile. So, her father raises money from the community, and the bank arranges so that as soon as the kidnapper accesses the account, that, like, the police can go after the guy. But they don't know where he's going to be until it's activated. And every time, by the time they get there, he's gone. And he accessed the ATM 3 times, and he's withdrawing the daily limit of $500. On March 7, 2012, however, the ATM starts happening in Arizona, then New Mexico, and then on March 10th, it's activated in Texas. So they're like, okay, so now he's not in Alaska right now, so we need to find him. So they start, like, watching the footage over and over, like, trying to figure out anything. They can't see any of his face because he always wears a mask. And, like, especially in Alaska, it's cold. Like, it's not suspicious to do that. But they notice that they see a white Ford Focus in the background of a lot of these videos. So they're like, okay, maybe that's his car. So they put an APB out. And in Texas, some cops see a white Ford Focus. And they're like, aren't we supposed to look for that? But, like, there's no reason to pull them over. But they're like, let's just follow them just to be sure. So they follow him, and the guy's going 3 miles over the speed limit, so they're able to pull him over for that. And they ask for his license and registration. And they look, and it's from Alaska, and it's for a guy named Israel Keys, who is driving the car. Like, okay, this is our guy, he's from Alaska, driving the car. So they're like, we're gonna search your car. When they search his car, they find Samantha's phone and her debit card.
Her phone. I thought you said her bone, and I was like, just one.
Oh, my ear fell out. I was thinking about this the other day. That's off topic. What if, like, our skeleton is just one bone? Like, one whole bone.
That'd be funny.
Thank you. So, he had a hearing in May, and he broke free of his shackles while he was in the courtroom. He jumped over the railing and had to be tackled and tasered to be subdued. And he's quoted saying, "Come on, let's face it, I'm a bad guy who tried to escape, but no one thought I was a good guy before that." You are correct, Israel. So, you're welcome to look up his, like, picture, but, like, he's, like, a generic-looking guy, like, the cliche, he doesn't look like a serial killer sort of thing. He had a girlfriend and a daughter, I think she was about 6 or 7. And at the time, he was in Texas for his sister's wedding. When he was growing up, he was raised in, like, from what I recall, he was originally raised in the Mormon church, and then they switched to a different church that was very problematic. Like, I don't know what the church was, but, like, it was racist, more or less, and, like, very white supremacist style, from what I understood. So when he was a teenager, he became very anti-establishment and kind of renounced the church he grew up in. And also killed cats. Fun stories.
No.
When he was older, ironically, he joined the military. His favorite drink was Wild Turkey Bourbon. And I think in 2001 or so, he was stationed in Egypt, and him and his buddies would, like, travel around. And he was eventually honorably discharged. And in 2001, he settles, I think, in Washington. And he has a kid, his daughter. And they moved to this town. And he says, "It wasn't surprising I would start murder, because this town was boring."
Oh.
2005, he goes to Alaska. So the police asked him about Samantha, and he told them not to expect her to come home. And he, like, describes what happened. So in February of 2012, he decided he's going to kill someone. He had no connection whatsoever to Samantha. He just thought a coffee shop was a good place to kidnap someone, and it stayed open the latest. He had zip-tied her, and while they were walking in the street, she escaped, but nobody heard her crying for help before he caught her again. And he took her to his shed, which was just behind where his girlfriend and daughter were asleep in their home. He told her that all he wanted was ransom, and if she cooperated, everything would be fine. But he had no intention of letting her live. He asked for her phone to send a ransom text, but she told him that she had left it at the coffee shop. So he leaves her there, goes back to the coffee shop, breaks in, grabs her phone, and comes back. And then he asks where her debit card is, and she tells him it's in her boyfriend's truck. So he goes and breaks into the boyfriend's truck. The boyfriend sees him and chases him, but he gets away. During, like, both these things, he just leaves her in the shed with the radio blaring, so, like, no one can hear her. But the next day, February 2nd, he assaults her, pours a large glass of wine, and then he kills her. He then goes inside his house and starts packing with his family for a cruise. They go on a cruise for 2 weeks in the Gulf of Mexico. And when he got back, he sent out the ransom note with the photo. So, how she had appeared alive in the photo is that he had taken fishing line and sewed her eyes open and then stuck the newspaper from that day. And then
I've seen this picture.
Yeah, I feel like I have too, but, like, I didn't know the story. Yeah, so I'm guessing you.
Either.
Hold on, I'm gonna send you the photo. Because of my drafts.
Yeah, I've seen it.
It's spooky.
She really does look alive. Yeah.
Okay. I just sent it for a nice refresher.
Who do you?
Now I have to find my line, part 8. He then dismembered her body, went to a lake, and he built like a little ice fishing shelter, and then disposed of her body in the lake, and the police were able to recover her body and return her to her family to be laid to rest. And then he's like, I won't confess anything else unless you guarantee I'll be executed within the year and the story isn't sensationalized so that my daughter doesn't find out. So simply put, he's like a psychopath. But, so like,
yeah.
They're like, we'll see what we can do, like, give us, like, tell us things. So, he would fly somewhere, rent a car, drive to a random town, and then bury a kill kit bucket with, like, weapons, ropes, Drano, trash bags and stuff in it, and he would leave it there for years sometimes. His only, like, rules were he wouldn't hurt children or dogs. And he tells the police about the murder of Lorraine and Bill Carrier. 8 months before murdering Samantha, he had flown to Chicago, rented a car, and drove 1,000 miles to Vermont. He picked them because there was an attached garage and he thought it would be easy to break into. So he broke in through a window, cut the phone line, barged into their room, told them to put on slippers because he didn't want their feet to get hurt, led them to the car, took them to an abandoned farmhouse. He shot Bill. Yeah, sorry. He shot Bill, sexually assaulted Lorraine, and then went to the backyard to smoke a cigar. Their bodies have never been found, and he said he put them their bodies in trash bags and covered them in Drano. All throughout, like, these 11 years or so, he also burglarized a lot. Like, he was confessed to, like, robbing a lot of banks and homes, like, to fund his hobby. He might be linked to up to 11 U.S. deaths, but people also speculate that he might have committed more overseas while he was in service. The kill kit he used to kill Bill and Lorraine, he had 2 years before. He was set to begin trial in March 2013, but on December 2nd, 2012, he was found dead in his cell. He was only 34 years old and committed suicide by hiding a razor and a pencil. He had a 4-page long letter that served as his suicide note called Ode to Murder. And under his bed, he drew 11 skulls in his own blood in a pentagram and said, "We are one," and people think that could be him referencing his 11 victims. And that's all I have on him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like it because, like, it was all random. Like, there was no connection. Like, his victims, he just said, I'ma do it.
Did you cut out?
No, I was finished talking. Hello? Do you hear me?
Oh, okay, that, I wasn't sure, that didn't have, like, a real clear end, so it was just radio silence for a little bit.
Yeah, I like, didn't notice the silence, all like, right. I don't
know.
Good
job.
Thanks.
Yeah, also, you didn't send me the picture.
Who did I send a random picture to? It was on Outlook?
No, did you send a picture of a dead body to someone else?
No, it's definitely to you.
Oh, you emailed it to me?
Yeah, I didn't want to save it to my phone.
I thought you texted it.
No, I'd rather email it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this picture is very odd.
Because I don't think you'd know if you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, ooh. At that point, she'd been dead for 2 weeks. And, like, yeah, Alaska's so cold. I was thinking her mouth looks a little...
Looks wrong. Yeah, Yeah, it looks kind of bruised almost.
Which I guess that makes sense for being kidnapped.
Yeah, don't look this up unless you want. Yeah. Don't look this up unless you want to see a dead body, but. Okay. What time are we at?
I think just 20. Hold on, I lost the tab. Yeah, we're at 20. That's it, just 20.
You have been listening to KHDX.FM in Conway, Arkansas. But more importantly, you are listening to The Witching Hour. So this is vaguely related to what I'm going to talk about today, but I'm just kind of curious. JC, have you heard about the Ghost Adventures? Like, I don't know if it's Zach a TV Baggins? Movie or what, but they go to, yeah, they go to investigate the Joe Exotic Zoo or whatever.
I don't think I've heard about that.
Tiger Sanctuary. Yeah, so they release, like, I don't know, is it an hour and a half? I think it might be. This hour and a half long investigation of Joe Exotic's, like, big cat zoo. And at first, because my sister was telling me about it, she was watching it, at first I was like, what kind of ghosts are they looking to find there? And then I remembered, like, Travis died there. And also,
wait, who was Travis again? I never finished watching it.
Travis was one of Joe's boyfriends, and he's the one who shot himself in front of that other guy in one of the buildings.
I only got to episode 2, so.
Oh, well, I don't even think I'm spoiling anything.
Yeah, like, it's not a spoiler at all.
At least knows.
Like, it's just to show, like, how much I don't know about it, just to give you some context of how little I know.
Yeah. So, if you want to watch the Ghost Adventure, here's an investigation of it, just skip until I stop talking about it. But, basically,
I'll skip right now.
For, Travis's ghost and get some interesting evidence, and then they also explore this rumor that there's no confirmation behind it, but it's kind of like widely thought to be kind of true that Joe shot and killed 2 protesters and then buried them somewhere on the property. And the whole thing is very interesting. Like, I missed the first half, I think, where they just talk about, like, the context and interview some people about experiences. But I watched, like, the second half, which was the actual investigation. Very interesting. Check it out if you're interested. Because there's this one scene that I would say is maybe one of the more compelling things that Ghost Adventures has ever gotten. If you believe in, like, the technology that they're using.
That's interesting. Fun fact. Oh, yeah.
That's my just little conversational intro.
We love a conversation. But there's an episode of That's Why We Drink, and it's about the history of Zach Baggins.
Yeah, I started listening to it, actually.
That's the one I'm on. I'm literally very far. 3 from the end. I can't get myself to finish it.
So, are you ready for my main
story? Yeah, I'm really excited.
Okay, I want to preface this by saying that I took most of this information from a YouTube video by Jenny Nicholson, and she does a way better job of, like, explaining it and diving into it, and she has, like, video clips from this that I think everyone should watch because they're really funny and just give even more, like, context to the story. So check her out on YouTube because she does a better job than me. But here we go. A family terrified in their own home. An investigator determined to find answers. A psychic searching for lost souls. And a home inspector who will prove them all wrong. In this week's episode, we're covering paranormal home inspectors. With a brief 2-season...
This sounds like the beginning of a really bad joke.
Yeah. With a brief 2-season, 13-episode run on Destination America, The low-budget show Paranormal Home Inspectors is thought to be one of the worst ghost hunting shows of all time. The show features a ragtag cast of three. Paranormal investigator and researcher Michelle McKay, who seems to be the central host, certified home inspector Brian Daly, and intuitive healer Nadine Mercy. Despite all being on the same show, none of the cast ever interacts with one another on camera. One of the aspects of the show that makes it fail is that all of the bigger shows have already investigated the better, more interesting locations, so they're getting the scraps that no one else wants. That's just some context for, like, what you should be picturing.
They just got roasted.
Three people who are never on camera together, and they are at, like, yeah, they're at the bottom of the barrel of haunted locations.
I feel like I may have seen it before, though.
Faceless British narrator. You can find, I think, all of the episodes on YouTube, and it might be on Netflix. I read that somewhere, but I don't know if that's still, like, up to date.
Like, I think I might have probably watched it when I was younger on the TV.
Yeah. At the start of each episode, a faceless British narrator presents the show's thesis statement, to combine natural and supernatural investigation to prove or disprove the existence of ghosts. Researcher Michelle interviews a family about their experiences in their home. These tend to be run-of-the-mill and include strange sounds and shadows, opening and closing doors, cold spots, faulty lighting and appliances, and even the odd apparition. In one episode, a homeowner describes the phone call interference he's been experiencing as, quote, "There have been times when it almost sounds like Satan has taken over the call." To begin the investigation, Michelle meets with the family to discuss their experiences as shown to the audience through dramatic reenactment, whether or not it makes interesting television. For example, like this show is just filmed so oddly, because they clearly saw, like,
what channel was it on?
These bigger ghost hunting shows, Destination America.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was a Canadian show, though, so I don't know if it aired in America, but it might have.
It's odd, because I probably just, whatever, what's it called, when placeboed myself.
Yeah, or Mandela effect or something.
That was what I thought originally, but I wasn't sure. But, like, I know there's a show, I think, on Destination America called Mysteries at the Museum. And based on how that's filmed, I would not be surprised.
Yeah.
I like the show, though.
That's a good show.
Yeah, but you have to admit, the filming's terrible.
Oh, yeah. This is worse. Each episode probably cost the network, like, $25 to film.
$25?
So, like I was saying, like, they've clearly seen, like, better paranormal investigation shows that have that, like, dramatic reenactment of these, like,
I never like them.
Scary occurrences. So they try to include that, but it's never good enough to warrant the reenactment, because there will be scenes where, like, they reenact walking into a room and feeling a cold spot. So it's just, like, the person walking in and kind of shivering.
Ooh.
It's not good.
They should have hired me to act it. It would have been great.
So Michelle will also ask foreshadowing. Yeah, it would have. Michelle will also ask foreshadowing questions about the house, such as whether or not they have had the house checked for mold, or, like, if they've done any renovations, or if they've ever had problems with, like, animals. So just keep that in mind. In the next portion of the show, Brian Daly goes through the house and debunks the paranormal claims. Quote, this is from Jenny Nichols' video. She says, he doesn't have any particular showmanship or charisma. He doesn't even seem to be fully aware that he's being filmed for a TV show. He just slowly moves through the house, crawling through ducts, examining wiring, crossing one thing after another off his list, joylessly debunking all of the ghosts we just heard about.
He sounds like a rat.
For example, in a number of episodes... No!
He's like crawling through vents!
That's part of the show.
He's crawling through vents and chewing on wires?
Yeah.
That's what rats do.
For example, in a number of episodes, Brian discovers that cold spots in the house were the result of poor insulation, that the doors that open and close by themselves were installed incorrectly, and that the strange noises in the night were caused by an animal infestation. There was even an instance where a glitchy computer was caused by a modem draped over an electrical line. In one notable episode, Ryan discovers that the reason a couple has been seeing an apparition at the top of their stairs is because the wall was actually touched up in two different white paints, one of which was slightly glossier than the other, and painted in a way where the glossier paint was incidentally in the shape of a human face. So when the couple climbed the stairs in certain lighting, it caused an optical illusion that made a face pop out from the wall.
That's pretty cool.
I know. And, like, it's crazy that he, like, noticed that.
He said, "Get me my flashlight. This paint is not the same color."
Quote, "I fell in love with this show in its very first episode, when Brian concludes his cut-and-dry tour through a home by looking down a drain in its creepy basement laundry room. He's uncharacteristically perturbed by what he sees. Quote, "I've seen a lot of things down drains, but I've never seen anything like this. It's not what I expected to see at all," he says. "There's things down there that are just kind of scary." Cut to commercial. Nadine visits the house, then Michelle, and that's it. Episode over. We're never told what Brian saw. The editing in the show is just so weird. It was clearly an intern who was just handed these clips and was like, figure it out.
And he did not.
And it's also, what's also interesting about it, yeah, what's also interesting about it is that the editing, okay, so like I've already said, like it starts with Michelle interviewing the homeowners about like all these like crazy experiences they're having, and then they send in the guy to debunk all of it, and then, as we'll hear later, they send in like the psychic, and they have a whole like nighttime paranormal investigation. So like, the way that it's edited, it sets it up like we're going to debunk all of it, and then we're still going to send all these other people in and get evidence of ghosts. If it had been like all of the paranormal stuff front loaded and then Brian comes in and debunks it, it might have actually like made it as a show, but the structure was so weird.
Sounds like quality entertainment.
If they had really leaned into the debunking aspect of it, it would have been a lot more interesting. Okay. After Brian's walkthrough, the show sends in intuitive healer Nadine Mercy. Obviously, the segment is poorly placed, as we just had Brian disprove almost every supposed paranormal occurrence. But regardless, Nadine walks through the house after allegedly having been given no prior information about the hauntings.
Oh, she reads from a cue card.
Noises that no one else can hear. Claims to be touched by phantom hands. And complains of a suffocating feeling pressing against her chest. Quote, "For context, here's how Brian and Nadine's dynamic plays out in the second episode. The homeowner worries that the pale markings that have appeared over his bed are some kind of writing or some kind of scribbling from beyond the grave. With a laugh, Brian quickly identifies them as residue from old wallpaper bleeding through the paint. But only a few minutes later, the same side has Nadine riveted. Is this for real?" she asks. To get a better look, she climbs, with her shoes on, onto their comforter and says, "I see fingers right here. It's like a bone. Hieroglyphics." Typically identifies multiple ghosts in the home that the show can easily link to the house's history in one way or another, and clearly relies on context clues from the house to weave a narrative for the ghostly inhabitants. In one episode, the couple in the house has what is obviously a memorial shrine of their dead daughter, complete with a big framed picture of her and candles, one of which has her picture on them and the words, "A celebration of life." Nadine walks to the shrine and says, "Something directed me to look at this picture. Did she pass away?" Coincidentally and sadly, Nadine, who often complained of having trouble breathing and feelings of suffocation whenever she toured a house, passed away from breast cancer in 2016 after pursuing mainly naturopathic remedies. So that's a sadder part of the story.
Yeah, I didn't know what to say to that.
Yeah. In segment 5 of the show, researcher Michelle takes a trip to a local library where she spends most of her screen time flipping through card catalogs. However, this normally results in her checking the whole town or a large radius around the house, where she inevitably turns up records of cemeteries, defunct prisons, secret societies, battle sites, train derailments, missing persons, and brutal murders. If these events took place anywhere near the house, she will find a way to link the two together. In one episode, she implies that two little boys who disappeared in 1916 from the city the house was in were murdered and at one time had their bodies hidden beneath the house. With no evidence, she says that. Then it cuts to someone asking Nadine if there is something buried beneath the house, to which she says no. And then someone asks if there was something buried there, and she pauses and says yes. In another episode, they tie a girl murdered in the area in 2009 to the house and say that her ghost is there, and start referring to her by name during their paranormal investigation. This girl died in 2009, and they're like, they're using that.
Yeah, that's show. Terrible.
Yeah, it's in the same episode. I think that this is the one with the shrine, like, of the daughter who had passed away. So they're already, like, linking the couple's daughter to the house and, like, calling her by name during the investigation.
That's just so manipulative.
And then they drag in this other, random girl who, you know, 2009, her parents are most likely still alive and well.
Mourning.
And they're like, oh, these two girls trapped in this house. And I'm like, okay, you can maybe do that with, like, the daughter of the owners of the house. They signed up to be on this show, but don't link in this other girl to it.
With, like, absolutely no reason. It's cheap and, like,
yeah,
absolutely, like, baseless, like.
Yeah, and she was murdered in the vague area of, like, maybe a 10-mile radius of the house. Segment 6 of the show features Michelle's return to the house at night for a paranormal investigation. This follows the formula of Michelle running around calling the ghost names, motion sensors going off, doors slamming, taps and appliances turning on, and ends with Michelle saying that she thinks they have enough evidence and then packing up and leaving.
She's like, we're good.
The crew's apparently high-tech ghost detecting. Yeah. No, it's so weird because they will be in the middle of, like, this chaos of, like, the sink is turning on, the ceiling fan is on, they're hearing doors slam and the motion sensor is going off, and she's like, yeah, I think we got enough evidence. Let's just pack it up and leave.
Time to roll out, guys.
It's, like, it's bad acting. Yeah. The crew's apparently high-tech ghost detecting equipment is never explained, and the editing renders the scenes jerky and chaotic. Quote, in one episode, she dashes outside after an apparent specter. Something's walking, she shouts. I can hear something walking in the leaves. Given that you are outside, probably an animal.
Wild.
Another quote. This is all from the same article, by the way. For their part, her team members aren't exactly the height of professionalism either, literally shrieking when they hear unexplained noises. One of Michelle's assistants ends up crying and shivering outside during an investigation. The camera zooms in unsteadily on her cross pendant. Get out, she instructs the spirit within her, according to Michelle. Get out of me. This segment normally lasts at most 5 minutes and consists of pretty obvious rigging and bad acting. This is kind of interesting. In the pilot episode, Michelle has an assistant for the segment, but she gets too scared and leaves halfway through the investigation and never returns to the show.
I'm laughing. It's not funny, but...
So she just quit during the middle of it.
It sounds a little funny.
It is funny. In the last segment, Michelle visits with the owners for a recap of the investigation. Michelle presents the information to the clients in the same order as the show revealed to us. She begins with Brian's debunking of the hauntings, which brings the owner some peace, and then she goes to what she and Nadine uncovered, which makes the owners believe that the house is haunted again. Perhaps the most memorable moment in the show features a pregnant woman named Christine who believes that dark spirits have followed her for her entire life and have left claw marks on her back and once even threw her from a chair. Christine becomes distraught after hearing Brian's summary and runs from the room. Quote, she takes off to the basement where she repeats out loud, to no one in particular, I'm not crazy, I'm not crazy, I'm not crazy. This is the scariest thing that happens in the entire series.
That does sound Like, you might be crazy.
Yeah, and I was reading the comments on, like, I watched that episode, and I was reading the comments, and people were like, what if the claw marks on her back are just stretch marks because she's pregnant? That makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
Oh, this is really funny. Or not really funny, I guess just kind of, like, odd. In one episode, Brian finds an issue with a furnace in the basement and believes that carbon monoxide poisoning might be causing the odd feelings and experiences that the owners have been experiencing. Michelle fails to bring this up during the recap, so she just doesn't tell him.
She's like, yeah, don't worry about it.
That they might be leaking carbon monoxide into their house.
Not a problem.
And, I don't have notes for this, but I'm just going to talk about it. In one episode, you know how, like, they have to, like, find all these vaguely connected occurrences that happened in the same town, and they're like, this is it. This is what's causing the ghost hunting.
Yeah.
Or the ghost haunting. Well, there's one episode where it's an office building. The office building used to be, like, where all the spiritualists in the 1800s hung out. Which we've covered spiritualists a lot in this series. So hopefully you know what I'm talking about.
Harry Houdini. You know,
was the society. Yeah, mainly of women that believed that they could contact the dead and that they were capable of, like, performing seances and stuff. So one of those societies was happening, or had happened, in this office building where they were now having, like, ghost experiences. But the evidence that they have for that episode is so lame, because the guy who they're interviewing is just like, we have this big fish tank, and when you walk up to it, the fish all get in this formation and swim up because they think that you're going to feed them. But sometimes we see them do that when there's nobody there.
Spooky.
Which I just think is funny and goofy.
It sounds like one of those shows you watch just to laugh at.
Yeah, so that's all that I have.
Off
yeah,
topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. Like, it sounds like a show that you found because you were staying home sick from school.
Yeah, I've watched some of those before.
What were we saying?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, fun fact regarding spiritualist, Arthur Conan Doyle was a big spiritualist. Like, he was really gullible and believed all that. I don't want to say, like, gullible, like, some people
yeah.
do, but, like, he was, like, known for being gullible with it. And Harry Houdini actively worked to disprove people. And he had, like, a group of women who helped him do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a lot of the details, but... fun fact of the day.
Crazy. Yeah, spiritualist is definitely... like, that whole spiritualism phenomena is probably my favorite historical time period. It's so fascinating to me because the amount of people who really believed in it, they were people who were, like, grieving and recovering from the Civil War and had, like, lost people in a way that, you know, they had never really lost people before. And then the amount yeah. of, like, charlatans in it who were just exploiting people for money. It's, I don't know, it's a really interesting time period where either you were so sincere about it, like, you really believed in, like, the cause or whatever, or you were tricking people out of their money.
Yeah, crazy times. The 1800s were just wild.
Mm-hmm. So, what time are we at?
44.
Well, all we need is another minute.
I mean, I figured you'd do, like, the closing off thing.
Oh, yeah. You have been listening to KHDX.FM in Conway, Arkansas. But more importantly, you have been listening to The Witching Hour. Just a reminder for the things that we covered in the beginning of this.
Give us Tad back.
Bring him home.
We love Tad. Tad is the mascot of the show.
Also, yeah, hopefully by the time this airs, we'll know who the president is. That'd be cool. I'd like to know.
I mean, I've been checking it during this. There's still six states who have not recorded or reported. And Georgia will definitely have a recount. And Pennsylvania currently have some votes that, like, aren't being counted because of a little bit of a legal dispute.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we know for now. And then I think Alaska just waits a week for fun.
So. I know. Well, I read that, like, Alaska is always, like, the last state to report just because for some reason their process is really slow. And I'm guessing it's because they're so spread out. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they only have one House representative, I believe. So they're very sparse.
It's cold up there.
Yeah.
It's cold up there, so they have to move slowly and, like, resist the urge.
It's so pretty up there, though.
But, you know, they do what they can.
Yeah, I'm not, like, trying to rush anyone. No, I've seen pictures and my grandparents went. So I live vicariously.
Yeah, I've been, of the swing states right now, I've been to Georgia, and I had a 3-hour layover in Las Vegas one time, so I'm just, like, thinking about that experience.
I think the farthest north I've been is Chicago. The farthest east I've been is Florida or Georgia. Probably, I think Georgia.
Yeah.
I think
the farthest east I've been is Florida. The farthest, like, north straight up, I guess, was Chicago. And then, like, to the west, I've been to California and Washington. And Canada.
I think west is probably Oklahoma for me. I don't remember going very far into Texas. Further south is, like, oh, I guess Florida. Like, straight down, it's just the tip, like, the cutting through part of Louisiana to get to Mississippi.
Yeah, me too. Okay, anyways, this was a riveting.
This is a fun geography lesson.
Thanks for listening. Tune in next week at 9 o'clock on Sunday. Follow us on Instagram at thewitchinghour.khdx.fm. Email us your personal scary stories, true crime, paranormal, whatever, to thewitchinghour.khdx@gmail.com.
Or just send us fan mail.
Email in the 3 semesters we've been doing this, but yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful.
That just send us love letters.
Yeah, for real. Tell me how much you love my podcast voice.
Anyway, my geography lesson of the day.
Bye.
Bye, wear your mask.
Yeah, bye.